about you guys, but I can't wait to get my hands on some Imaginarium commissary food.
Ooh, you are so right, Annie. This exploration of the extinct attractions of Tomorrowland has been one heck of a journey. That ride through the Hall of Forgotten Tomorrowland attractions we just rode in the last two episodes was truly one of a kind.
And getting to explore much of it on foot was equally incredible.
What luck that it would break down like that for us, allowing us to pore over more of the details placed in the attraction by the Imaginarians. Wait, what's that?
What is what?
Look at the end of the moving walkway. It looks like another room to explore.
Leave it to the Imaginarians to give us one more plus of things to explore. What does the placard above the door say?
It says Tomorrowland Flying Saucers.
Are we going to fly over Tomorrowland in some sort of UFO?
As cool as that sounds, I doubt it, Annie. If anything, I think we're going to encounter one of the most infamous attractions in all of Tomorrowland history.
Well, there's only one way to find out. Let's check it out!
Great idea. I suppose the commissary can wait.
Here it is, you guys, the one and only Tomorrowland Flying Saucers.
Oh, I never thought I'd see it quite like this. I've seen pictures and some fuzzy old film clips, but here it is, live in all its pulsing, bouncy goodness.
I don't mean to be rude. I know this is one of those beloved extinct attractions everybody who grew up in the 60s raves about, but I mean, it's just bumper cars, right?
Well, kind of. Obviously, there was a big enthusiasm for bumper cars at that period of time.
Oh, yeah. People in the 50s loved to give their friends whiplash. It's like, hey there, Joe. How's that life-altering neck injury treating you?
Oh, hiya, Gordon. Yeah, it's doing just fine. I can't turn left or right, and I'm unable to bend at the waist, but two tranquilizers and a highball, and I'm sleeping like a baby.
Anything for the kids, eh, Joe?
That's the ticket, Gordy. But the twist on these particular bumper cars is that they had something special. Disney magic.
So the flying saucers were bumper cars that literally floated on air.
So the saucers, if you ever saw a picture, the saucers are round, single-seat vehicles with inflated bumpers all the way around. They floated on a cushion of air in a specially made flying saucer arena. So the smooth metallic floor was honeycombed with these plate-sized holes, each one with a hair-triggered damper flap that opened automatically and when a flying saucer slid over it. A near solid blast of air blew upward, keeping the flying saucer afloat on a pillow of wind, just like a giant air hockey puck.
The cool part about it was the way the saucers moved.
Yeah, that's right. If you leaned left, your weight would push you towards closed dampers, which would open and keep you afloat and moving in that direction. Lean right, and the air would float you right. And if you stayed still, the air could bounce you up and down and up and down and up and down.
I gotta say that this may have been the most playful and interactive attraction at the time. I mean, unlike any other attraction, apart from maybe Autopia, you had complete control of the vehicle, and your only goal was to bump a friend and laugh about it. That's amazing.
On the attraction's opening day, they flooded the Flying Saucer Arena with colorful balloons and beach balls. What an amazing experience that must have been.
Oh, no doubt, no doubt. But the saucers, unfortunately, were destined for the dustbin. Even from day one.
Oh, why though? It actually seems like a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, one of the big success factors for a theme park ride is throughput. How many people can you cycle through a ride in 1 hour? There are some serious people eaters at Disneyland these days, but the big dogs being Pirates of the Caribbean and It's a Small World with over 3,000 people per hour. And then there's Haunted Mansion and Big Thunder Mountain in the mid-2,000 people an hour. The Flying Saucers couldn't do much more than a few hundred guests per hour, meaning only a fraction of the people who came to the park each day could ride the ride.
Which is a shame. The other thing was that the ride had some really big technical problems that consistently haunted it. Think about the mechanical efforts to keep 30-something vehicles airborne for 2 minutes at a time. There were a lot of breakdowns, and for a ride that couldn't handle very many riders, its days were numbered. So after just 5 years in 1966, the Flying Saucers flew their last.
Not exactly, Alex.
Oh, really, Annie?
I seem to remember writing something just like the flying saucers at California Adventure within the past 10 years or so.
Annie, you're right. You're talking about Luigi's flying tires in Cars Land. While much of the concept was the same, the flying tires had the same hourly capacity problem, along with continued technical issues. It only lasted a few years as well. The air compressors that were needed to make them work just couldn't keep up with the demand.
Well, I guess you can't win them all. Get it?
Al, that joke is full of hot air.
Nice one, Annie. You're not just a pretty face, you know.
Ah, as much as I like letting the puns fly, we should keep moving, shouldn't we? That commissary food isn't going to eat itself. Oh, but before we do, I have one more question about the flying saucers.
Oh, what is that question, Andrea?
It's just, where were they? The flying saucer arena looks huge in the pictures I've seen. I just don't get where they were located.
Same here. There aren't a lot of the same landmarks in Tomorrowland around anymore. It's hard to tell from pictures if it was over by Autopia, or was it back in Space Mountains area now, or right in the middle of the plaza? I just don't get it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a head-scratcher for me, too. I mean, honestly, I guess that's a mystery for another time.
Fair enough, Al. We've got to have a few mysteries in life to keep us going, I guess.
One thing that isn't a mystery is my monumental thirst and hunger. Which way to the commissary?
Right through these doors, friends.
Amazing how quickly we can transfer from the immersive world created in the Hall of Forgotten Tomorrowland attractions and back out into the Imaginarium testing floor.
Too true, Freddy. Sheesh. Looking around here, there has to be 100 projects being worked on all at once.
Here at the Imaginarium, we are currently working on 121 world-altering projects.
Wait, who said that?
I know that voice.
Oh, yeah, me too.
It came from over there, behind the large sphere portal to another dimension thingy.
The best and brightest minds from all over the world have converged right here in this laboratory, all with the vision to create a brighter, more hopeful tomorrow.
Oh, gosh, that can only be the voice of...
Professor Julius Sneck!
Professor Sneck, I thought I'd never see you again.
We also recognize the extreme public interest in Disneyland's extinct attractions, as well as the scientific implications of the advancements documented therein.
Professor Sneck, it's me, Annie.
So our
I don't think he can see us, Annie. It's like he's talking to a room full of people and doesn't know we're here.
But he's right there in front of us, almost looking me in the eye.
I think he might be one of those positional referencing holograms. See how he maintains eye contact no matter where we stand?
Yeah, sadly, Annie, I got bad news. It's not Sneck in the flesh. This is the last project that Dr. Sneck worked on before the incident on the cruise ship during our exploration of It's a Small World.
Talk about your all-time disappointment.
I'm sorry, Annie. I know you two became really close during your time together in the past.
Yeah, he was like a grandfather to me.
Well, the only consolation I can give is that this program was rumored to contain highly responsive AI technology, almost to the point where it's like having the real Sneck back in the room.
Wow, it's impressive, all right.
It really is. We were hoping to place these in museums all around the world so Sneck could focus on his work here without having to travel to hundreds of speaking engagements.
Oh, so that explains why he looks positively radiant.
I think you're right, Freddy. There is a kind of glow about him.
And now, the Imaginarium Institute presents to you for the very first time the multidimensional historic attraction viewer we call Extinctovision.
Extinctovision? Weird name, but this sounds interesting.
I agree. Let's see what old hologram Sneck has in store for us.
Take hold of the control panel in front of you. Using the simple three-button positional interface, you are able to quickly select an extinct attraction of interest to you and study it in greater detail than ever before possible. Tilt your paddle forward, and you'll virtually swoop down into the Tomorrowland of the past. Tilt left or right to discover an attraction. Button right to select, button left to expand.
Cool! Look how you can select an attraction and it expands into layers of time.
You begin with the layers of time dimension. Each layer allows you to see what attractions existed in this location before and after at any given date from 1955 until today.
Whoa. Well, it's like an onion peeling back its layers.
Like an onion peeled back, revealing layer upon layer.
See?
Extinctivision allows you to see what lies beneath and above your currently selected dimension.
Yeah, it's like an archaeologist digging down to see what was there before.
Unlike an archaeologist digging down to see what was there before.
Ah, shucks.
The layers of time function does not require digging or destruction of existing attractions to reveal the true story of the past.
Guys, are you thinking what I'm thinking?
That they messed up Sneck's nose a little in the programming?
Oh, not that, Freddy, though. Now that you mention it, I can't unsee it. Ugh, yeah, it's like a churro that's been dropped on the ground and into a puddle. You just can't stop looking at it.
First of all, that literally makes no sense. And secondly, ow, focus, what are you thinking?
Oh, that's right. I'm thinking we ask him
where the flying saucers were located. Al, when you're not thinking about abandoned food, you have a great idea every once in a while.
Puddle churro just isn't natural.
Oh, Al. Sneck, where are the flying saucers located?
Whoa, this doohickey really does work quickly.
You are now viewing the flying saucer's location as it appeared when it opened in 1961. Tilt left to go back in time, and tilt right to go forward.
Whoa! The flying saucers just disappeared, and in their place is just a vacant lot.
Look, it says year 1955.
So it looks like the flying saucers were in that space between Starcade and the Pizza Port restaurant.
Yeah, kind of where Space Mountain is now, I guess.
Oh, I can't believe it. So when Disneyland opened, that spot in the park was just bare, I guess. Just a little fence blocking off backstage and shade structures.
And if I tilt it right, we can see the flying saucers in that spot. And then, wait, what's that? It's an outdoor theater of some sort.
Year 1967, the year all of Tomorrowland got transformed.
Oh, the Tomorrowland stage!
Ooh, yeah, that's right. I've seen that in old documentaries. A lot of incredibly talented people used to play there. Jan and Dean, Paul Revere and the Raiders, Frankie Avalon, and Annette Funicello.
Oh man, Disneyland was once the place to see the most popular musicians in the world, and the Tomorrowland stage was the hottest venue in the park. This is where Disneyland's own All-American College Band, the Kids of the Kingdom, and the New Mouseketeers used to entertain guests every single day.
And it's where grad night teenagers came to hang out and dance the night away.
Ooh. Oh, wait. Click the time-lapse button.
It made Disneyland age quite quickly, but may I add, still gracefully.
It looks like the Tomorrowland stage was demolished in 1977 and replaced by a different, smaller stage called the Space Stage.
It was also replaced by pieces of Space Mountain as well.
Whoa, this machine has some amazing potential to explore Disneyland on even greater levels. I could be here all day, twisting dials, pushing buttons, and zooming in to all areas of the park.
What was that?
That would be my stomach, protesting an all-day exploration of this device.
She's right, Freddy. We should probably grab a bite.
Fair enough, guys. Foodie calls.
Have you completed the journey through the layers of Tomorrowland's past?
We have indeed, Doctor.
Have you completed the journey through the layers of Tomorrowland's past?
It's like he didn't hear me.
Have you completed the journey through the layers of Tomorrowland's past? To respond to my query, simply say the words, Dr. Sneck, followed by your response.
Oh, okay.
Typical voice assistant loves to hear their own name.
Dr. Sneck, we're finished using the device.
Shall I power down now?
Dr. Sneck, no!
You would like me to abort the powering down?
Guys, as lame as this sounds, I can't bear to see Sneck go again. Even if this is just a holographic version of turning him off. I was just coming to peace with the fact that we may never see him again until this hologram came along and got my hopes up.
I'm really sorry about that, Annie. It does have to be tough.
It is. But in a strange way, it seems like keeping this hologram on keeps a piece of him with us here in the lab.
Then, in that case, Dr. Sneck, remain on.
Acknowledged. I shall remain on and responsive. Simply say my name whenever you need my help. I'm just a Dr. Sneck away.
There you go, Annie.
Thanks, Al. Like I said, I know it's strange.
Not strange at all, Annie. Now, what do you say we head over and taste this floating root beer?
Root air. It's root air, Freddy. Though I'm now seeing that calling it a root beer float is much more clever. Ooh. But anyway, right this way. How do you spell refreshment? R-O-O-T-A-I-R? R?
Keep working on that slogan, Al.
Well, now that we've been fed and rooted and we're back in the studio, what do you guys say we finish up our exploration of these extinct attractions?
Oh, great idea, Annie. So like we said earlier, there are only a few left to cover. And let's start with something called the Art of Animation.
Ah, yes. The Art of Animation display would take over the Satellite View of America attraction we talked about in the previous episodes. This display was focused on telling the story of animation. You see, Walt was particularly keen on taking people behind the scenes to show them how things worked and operated. You can see some great examples of this in the film The Reluctant Dragon, the television series The Wonderful World of Disney, and that legacy is continued throughout the parks to this day. But the Art of Animation display was really the first display of its kind. After the release of Sleeping Beauty, Walt got particularly excited about sharing the process of animation in a three-dimensional space for people to explore. So in 1958, he created two traveling exhibits that would show that very process. Around the same time, author Bob Thomas would pen a book entitled The Art of Animation that would tell the story of the animation process from beginning to end by following Sleeping Beauty's production from start to finish. This book would become the catalyst for many influential artists today, both inside the company's walls as well as around the artistic community. It was considered the gold standard for animation in its time and is still revered to this day for its influence.
I gotta interject and say Bob Thomas also wrote what I think is the greatest biography of Walt Disney of all time, entitled Walt Disney, An American Original. It is absolutely worth the read, friends.
I second that. After traveling around the United States, the Art of Animation display would find a home in Disneyland from May 28, 1960 to September 5th, 1966. One of the unique things about the Disneyland version of the display was that you could peruse through a bin of actual cells from your favorite Disney films and purchase them for $2.
Oh my goodness, can you imagine being able to do that now? Like, what I wouldn't give.
Oh, they would be sold out in like 6 seconds, and there would also be over 125 trampling-related injuries.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, how times have changed.
Sadly, yes. But over time, things changed for the Art of Animation display as well, which would, as we said earlier, close down in September of 1966 to make way for bigger and brighter attractions. And speaking of bigger and brighter tomorrows, that leads us to the conversation around our next extinct attraction. Probably one of the most iconic in Disney park history, the People Mover. The People Mover's roots find themselves not in the theme parks, but on the world's stage.
What do you mean by that?
Well, in previous episodes, we've talked about Walt's involvement with the 1964-65 World's Fair. Walt was contacted by various organizations to create attractions for their pavilions at the fair, and as a result, we would get It's a Small World, Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln, Carousel of Progress, and Ford's Magic Skyway, which is where the People Mover tech came from. All of these attractions were great one-offs for the fair, that would eventually make their way back to display at Disneyland. But one of them had a much grander, much greater purpose, and that was the People Mover.
I've never heard the words greater purpose and People Mover in the same sentence, Al. So please explain.
With pleasure, my friend. You see, Walt was a man who always had many, many irons in the fire, meaning he was working on multiple projects all at once. And towards the end of his life, Walt had more irons than ever. Between working on animated and live-action films, he was also developing Pirates of the Caribbean for Disneyland, while also working on World's Fair projects, while working on Mineral King Ski Resort and the infamous Florida Project.
Wow, that overwhelms me just hearing about all the projects at once.
Same here, but one of the things that Walt was great at was double-dipping. For instance, Walt was developing the projects for the companies at the World's Fair, while also knowing that those projects would eventually become a part of Disneyland's attraction lineup. With the Wedway People Mover, he also knew that it would serve another purpose.
And what purpose was that?
Well, it would serve as the main mode of transportation for Epcot in Florida.
Ah, Epcot! I love World Showcase. Norway has the cutest ugly trolls.
Well, not quite that Epcot, Annie. I'm talking about Walt Disney's original Epcot, which stood for Experimental Prototype Community of Tomorrow.
What?
That's right. Walt was looking to build an entire city in the swamplands of Florida. This prototype city would be, according to Walt's vision, a model for all modern U.S. cities to follow in design, operation, and commerce. It was a veritable utopia of sorts. But honestly, this rabbit hole is so vast, so deep, and so dense that we've decided that after we're finished exploring the attractions here in Disneyland on the backside of water, we'll be tackling this immense, amazing, and awesome story behind Epcot.
Oh my gosh, that's going to be so fun. But wait, do you mean that the People Mover was going to be the main mode of transportation for Epcot?
Well, you see, Annie, Walt Disney hated the highway system. He saw the concept of the quote-unquote commute as killing the modern American community. Living in one place and working in a different city meant that you were torn in half, one half being your home life and one half being your work life. He saw the highway as the metaphor for this tearing of the American soul, and he aimed to fix this by creating a place where people could live and work, all while traveling in a communal, efficient way. Enter the People Mover.
The original inception of the People Mover was not in the ride vehicle we all know and love, but in the technology of the attraction itself. You see, the tech is unique in that the ride vehicle itself doesn't have any electronic moving parts per se. Instead, the ride vehicle was propelled along by a series of linear induction motors. These motors are commonly seen on modern roller coasters to move cars past the areas where centrifugal force won't take them. This tech would move Ford convertibles along a track that would take riders through some fun and playful dioramas, one of which can be found at the Disneyland Railroad, the Primeval World. Well, after the fair, Walt decided to use the Trek technology from the Magic Skyway, but opted to use a new vehicle entitled the Wedway People Mover. This People Mover would be used to transport people from the residential areas of Epcot to its commerce and business hubs in the middle of the community and back out again. These cars were constantly moving, with the loading platform moving along with the vehicles. This made the loading process amazingly efficient and speedy, allowing for minimal wait times when coming home from work. Very much unlike the rush hour congested highways of Southern California. But,
real quick, Freddie, yep. with this, one thing, I don't mean to cut you off, but one thing that this reminds me of is when you were talking about efficiency earlier. And one of the things that we were looking at is how many people can get through an attraction. And you call those big ones people eaters. Well, one of the biggest people eaters of all time was the People Mover. It could get over 4,000 people per hour through the People Mover. So it's amazing to see how efficient this technology was that they created. I just wanted to throw that in there and say that it reminded me of what you were talking about earlier, because I thought that was fascinating what you were bringing up.
They should have just called the People Mover the People Eater.
They really should
probably would have been too scary.
I feel like if they would have given each one a one eye and one horn and made it fly.
That would be a great holiday Halloween layover, wouldn't it? The one eye and one horn flying purple People Mover. Yes.
I love it.
Needs to happen.
Sorry, continue to tell us about the People Mover, Freddie. I'm sorry to derail us.
All right. There's no derailing because the People Mover is on a linear motion system.
Oh, that's
it's not
true.
Like,
that's
not
all
like
right, all right, all right.
All right. But this People Mover would also be put to use in Disneyland, no doubt to showcase the technology and for Walt to show investors in Epcot that his tech actually worked. Sadly, Walt would die before Epcot even broke ground, and the only People Mover to make it to the general public would be the one found in the parks. The Wedway People Mover would open in 1967, but again, instead of using limb technology to propel the vehicles, the People Mover would use tires placed every 9 feet to do the heavy moving. These tires were Goodyear tires, and for good reason, as Goodyear was the sponsor of the attraction when it first opened.
I wanted to see how many times we could use the word good.
How good is
sentence.
That?
So the People Mover would carry folks above the hustle and bustle of Tomorrowland on a leisurely 16-minute cruise. The track itself was called the Glideway, and along your journey you would be able to observe murals created by Disney legend Mary Blair, view the queue area where Monsanto's mighty microscope was housed, as well as the pavilion areas for the Carousel of Progress and America the Beautiful. It also would take you over the submarine voyage and Autopia, giving you panoramic views of Walt's vision of tomorrow. The People Mover was originally a D-ticket attraction, meaning it was considered to be one of the most sought-after rides, even though it only traveled between 1 and 7 miles per hour. With the People Mover, it wasn't the speed, it was the joy of the journey, especially for folks looking to give their tired, park-weary feet a little break.
Oh yes, I agree. Eventually, the People Mover would be such a staple of Tomorrowland that it would also make its way into Tomorrowland of the Magic Kingdom. But alas, as seems to be the case with most Tomorrowland attractions, the People Mover's days were numbered in Tomorrowland. By the early 1990s, the attraction had started to show its age, and a lack of refurbishments had made the People Mover look a bit dreary. But despite this dreariness, People Mover remained a popular fan favorite attraction. It would seem that a refurb was in order for the attraction, but that's not what the Disney executive team had in mind. It's rumored that at this time in park history, the Disney company was starting to shift funds toward more park merchandising and marketing pushes, and away from refurbishing what they saw as old, worn-out attractions. This, coupled with the fact that Tomorrowland was lacking multiple e-ticket attractions, meant that the People Mover was a prime target for the chopping block. And on August 21st, 1995, the People Mover would move its last person.
Aww. I have to say, I would have loved to have ridden the original People Mover. I've ridden the one in Walt Disney World, which is amazing. And for those of you who go down there, the Walt Disney World version of the People Mover even drives you past a little scale model of the original Epcot design in diorama form. So it's going to transport you into the past ever so slightly down there. So when we start talking about Epcot, you're going to want to go ride the People Mover. Except I think it's called the Tomorrowland Transit Authority or something like
that.
They
call it the TTA, but everybody calls it the People Mover.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Fair enough.
That's so cool. I'd love to go ride it again because I rode it when I was really young in Disneyland.
Yeah, I think that... Well, I would love to see exactly where it took you through the entire Tomorrowland. Freddie, I'm assuming
goodness.
You wrote it?
We need to get that machine that Sneck showed us earlier to go through all the layers of everything that was in People Mover. Okay, so off script here, pal. Listen.
There's no script here, Freddie.
No,
we're
no,
just
never
talking
a script.
Cup,
we're just
right?
talking off the cuff. Listen, the People Mover was an amazing trip. It really, really was. And you can actually still look at the track, obviously, and see where it went. And the goal was to give you, like the railroad that goes around Disneyland, was to give you a grand circle tour of the world of the future in Tomorrowland. And you took off out of the station, heading straight towards the hub. You made a left turn, which went inside the building where the... Journey Through Inner Space and now Star Tours is. When it was Inner Space, you went past, you opened up into the queue and you could see the mighty microscope sending little tiny people into a giant snowflake. When it was Star Tours, there were stormtroopers standing over that area and they would hover, they would sort of move back and forth. It was these great animatronics that all that worked was their hips and their knees. They looked like they were just swaying on the front of a ship. And you look down into the queue. It was awesome. And then as soon as you went into that room, once Star Tours was there, C-3PO would take over as your narrator, along with R2-D2. Then you went back through and into Space Mountain. You actually went over Star Traders. You could see people shopping. So remember, the goal was always to show people what other attractions they're missing out on.
Yeah, what you can get.
Them. And then you would go into Space Mountain and you would see cars go by and you'd be in the dark. And it was always a fun thing to be able to see Space Mountain with the lights on. If you ever were on the People Mover, that was the way to see it. Because it was a slow move through Space Mountain if the lights were ever on for a derail or anything. Then it came outside. You do not even want to miss this. Then it came outside one more time out there by Pizza Port. and went into what was once the Carousel of Progress and then the America Sings attraction, and which is now, I guess, Star Wars Launch Bay. And you went into that thing, and on the second floor of that room, they had a the first projection mapping stuff that would ever happen. And you were going slowly through as on a people mover track, slowly through, but the images that they showed on the side were fast moving. They had you going by race cars, or they had you going by speed boats, and it would feel like you were moving, and they blew wind on you. So it felt like you were moving super, super fast, but really you were moving at a slow people mover pace. And then, my friends, they changed it in the 80s to Tron light cycles. You were in the Tron ride at in Shanghai and Florida are not the first Tron rides at Disneyland. It was the people mover, and you would see the motorcycles, the light cycles chase in front of you and block you off, and it was the most amazing feature. That was just the first couple minutes. And then you went outside and down over Autopia. You went in and around to Autopia, went down around and over the lagoon, the submarine lagoon. Then you went in and through right next to the monorail. At points, you were chasing with the monorail. And then it finally went into back into the Tomorrowland building, where right across from Alice in Wonderland bathrooms. And it would go back into the building there, which was at the time an America the Beautiful, the Circle Vision room, and you would see people standing in line waiting for the Circle Vision movie. And then suddenly you were back out on the main street, the main drag of Tomorrowland, heading back to the station. It was amazing, and I wish we could use Sneck's machine to go back and see that one. Oh!
We might be able to find something in the Imaginarium that could allow us to do that. I have to say, though, listening to you, that's the incredible thing about the People Mover, is the fact that it was beloved by so many people. You never really talk to anybody who's like, the People Mover, take it or leave it. They are the prophets of the People Mover.
We are just enthused, aren't we?
It's my mom's favorite ride. She still talks about it. Oh, I miss the People Mover.
Well, and while I was researching this, since unfortunately I didn't get the chance to ride this thing myself outside of the Walt Disney World version, there's something that speaks to what Tomorrowland used to be. I think that once Space Mountain hit, there was kind of this need for speed inside of Tomorrowland. And I think Tomorrowland became like the extreme side of Disneyland goers. That if you were looking for something extreme, then you go hang out in Tomorrowland. But when Tomorrowland first opened, that's not at all, as we've seen through this exploration, that's not at all what Tomorrowland was about. And the People Mover is the perfect example of that. That here you are taking a tour, and really, the concept of the People Mover is, it's not the thrill of the ride, it's the concept behind the ride that made it so awesome. That Walt Disney was again showing off, saying, this is something that we're all capable of using. This is how we can travel this way in the future. And to me, that's what I loved about Tomorrowland, was it felt like a living World's Fair because of those little things that Walt Disney put in there like that at the beginning.
One last People Mover note. You can still ride a Bob Gurr. Bob Gurr is the guy who designed the People Mover system. You can still ride a Bob Gurr-designed People Mover in the Houston airport.
What?
There is one out in the wild. There is one in the wild.
Wow.
Wait, and it's rideable?
It takes you. So the Houston airport has a lot of terminals and a lot of hotels that are attached to it. And so the People Mover goes underground. And it's just like it's encased. It's enclosed. But go online and check it out. You can see the Wedway People Mover being used in the Houston airport.
I need to just fly to Houston just for that.
I know, that's what I was thinking too.
No C-3PO, no Space Mountain.
But we can pretend.
But there's a nice Marriott at the end.
I've stayed there.
Yeah.
Oh, a Marriott.
Then that's worth it. As long as they provide a warm bed and a nice swimming pool, I'm in. I'm in.
Freddie, your description brought back so many memories from my childhood that were really down in there. And, like, I forgot, but, yeah, I remember C-3PO and R2-D2.
I'm so jealous of you two.
I know. I'm so jealous of you two.
Well, I think I was about 4 or 5, and then that was...
Maybe Snek can implant the memory into you.
That would be awesome if I could incept that, if he could incept that into my brain, because I'm an old Disney fan. Like, I grew up...
You are old. Yeah.
That's definitely apparent. But I grew up, the only Disney experience that I had when I was a kid, guys, was a book, a coffee table book. And I would obsessively look through that thing, and it was all about the opening of Epcot. And I would just look through that and dream about being in the park, because my parents were like, "Oh, it would be a lot more fun if we dug holes in the backyard. That's what we're gonna do instead of going on a Disney trip." And so, I grew up just dreaming in a book and hearing these stories about these extinct attractions that you guys were able to ride. I just want to be you guys for one day. For more than just that reason, I just want to be you guys for a day, because you're both so cool.
Thank you, Alex.
But speaking of transporting you to other places, we need to cover the last of the major extinct attractions in Tomorrowland. The American Space Experience. Opened in 1998, this exhibit would celebrate 40 years of NASA's space explorations. This installation would feel much more like a museum than an attraction, but it would fit very well into the walls of Tomorrowland. Here, guests would be able to look at various NASA vehicles and spaceships, moon rocks from the Apollo 16 mission, iconic spacesuits used on the International Space Station, and more. For avid space exploration nerds, this exhibit offered all the high notes one would find from an educational space experience, which is also one of the reasons it closed so quickly. Not a lot of people wanted to spend their time at Disneyland exploring a museum of space stuff, sadly. As a result, the American Space Experience would close in 2003.
But you know, the space that the Space Experience took up is really a memorable space for a lot of people who had spent a lot of their youth at Disneyland. That space wasn't just made for space experience. It actually had a whole lot of other needs and uses for Tomorrowland. Tomorrowland had a thesis that it would talk about both space travel and regular travel, transportation, and communication. And this was one area that used to be filled with communication stuff. Can I do a sidebar real quick?
Just
what used to be in that little spot, it's just this little pocket. Like right now, you can get your FastPass distribution thing for Buzz Lightyear. We're getting rid of FastPasses. FastPasses are already gone. But if you used to go get your Buzz Lightyear FastPass distribution right there in front of where that NASA space experience, and just above it was that Mary Blair, beautiful Mary Blair
mural.
Mosaic mural showing children of the world, which they are our future. That was the whole goal of that. But I remember going into that space when it was the AT&T Center, and it was a really cool open area that you could go in and learn about phone communication. Now, AT&T was the sponsor when I was young. Before that, it was Bell Labs Telephone Center. Like, old people, I barely remember that when LA had only one area code. You would watch on TV and they would say, you can get a hold of blank, call Disneyland at blank, blank, blank. It was just, they didn't have the area code. And if they did, they would say, that is in the area code 714. Like, they didn't know how to just say a phone number without an area code. So you would go into the AT&T room when I was young, and there were a bunch of different ways to communicate. One of which, and I know there's listeners who remember this, they had a room that you could go into. It was a glass room with benches inside, a couple seats, maybe room for four people six if some are standing. This glass room. You go in the glass room, and on the wall was a payphone. And that payphone, I know, and that payphone, which you did have to put money into, could call out to your family and friends using AT&T's system. Call out. But here was the cool thing. It didn't have a handset. So the room had speakers in it and microphones, and you could talk to your friends without having to hold on to the phone receiver. So it was
but
like,
everyone else heard,
and
right?
Everybody else could hear, and you would have this speakerphone experience for the first time at Disneyland. And we would line up outside that thing to call a friend, call your parents, call whatever, and say, hey, guess what? We're all in a room. And the people on the other end wouldn't get it. They'd be like, okay, what's the big deal? Visual. Except they would hear a bunch of teenagers screaming at them and laughing, going, ha ha, because we're all talking without holding up a handset to our head. That was cool.
But I bet it was so unique at the time, right?
Yeah, it was. People didn't have speakerphones in their house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I loved about Tomorrowland in general, is it was all about the novelty. Yeah. All of these new things that were coming out like that were just a bunch of fun.
Yeah.
And I to do a completely off-topic aside, or I should say tangent here, I wish that that's the way Tomorrowland was still.
Yeah.
I see the cost prohibition from it, because you can't just keep up with all of the new technology constantly. I mean, I think that's what they tried to do, and we'll talk about this obviously in the Inventions episode, but that's what they tried to do with Inventions, is they tried to keep the spirit that was alive in Tomorrowland all inside Inventions, and even that they couldn't keep up with, because whenever a new year came around, you're looking at millions of dollars of refurbishment just to keep up with that year's technology, let alone what was going to happen in the future.
Yeah.
But that's what was so cool, is back in, you know, even 30 years ago, technology didn't move at the lightning pace that it did now.
Yeah.
And the things that were so impressive 30 years ago stayed impressive for a good couple of years, where you could go into that phone booth and have a raucous little time.
Experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. Before that, that same space was filled with the Bell Telephone Labs, and I don't remember, and I'd have to look it up to see if it was around when I was around, but one of the other things that I loved and remembered and experienced was that this was where you could go to a phone, and they had this wall, this beautiful wall that was made to look like the castle, and you could see different Disney characters on that castle. And they were like in little circles. So you'd see Snow White's face, you'd see Pluto's face, you'd see Jiminy Cricket's face, right? And there was this bank of telephones, and you could pick up that phone, and with the 9 digits or the 10 digits, you could, up on the wall, it would show Goofy's face, and it would say number three. And so you would push a button, number three, and you could talk to Goofy, and Goofy would come on and say, hey, pal, great to see you here at Disneyland. Buy a Bell telephone phone.
Of course. That's so cute.
Tell
though.
Your mom Bell telephone's the only way to call her friends. So super cute.
Subversive marketing.
No, yeah. And it was so fun, and you would want to get up there, and you'd push your brother and sister out of the way to get to the phone, and you would call, you know, Jiminy Cricket, whoever was your favorite, and then the parents would have to come in and regulate. But
well, wait, didn't they have something like that? They carried that over in Toontown for a while, didn't they?
Well, didn't they? Well, they have phones, different, various phones, but you didn't get to choose who you were talking to.
It was kind of a randomized thing that you would pick up and they would talk.
Yeah, super fun, so that carries through.
Yeah, because from my understanding, we all have a mutual friend, Mr. Mike Mulligan, who was friends with one of the characters on a phone experience like this too in the park, Stitch.
That's true.
And was that the same thing? Was this like the updated version of what you were talking about?
Yeah, I think it was. You could call up Stitch, and he would talk to you. Pretty cool, live and interactive.
It's amazing.
That's cool.
Yeah, that telephone technology was so on the forefront. Because, I mean, think about how that innovated communication.
Oh, yeah.
And again, when you see when you see the rest of Tomorrowland, when we talk about like the Hall of Chemistry or the Aluminum Hall of Fame, all these different things that seem so silly, but they were revolutionary for the time. We look back and we're like, oh, how kitschy, how quaint.
Yeah.
But in reality, those types of things were just world-altering for the Americans living in that time period, which I think is awesome. I love hearing stories like this.
Yeah. It was a really great exit to an attraction. If you went into the Circle Vision, that was your exit, and you would go into that room. And years later, that became the exit to the People Movers' grandchild, which we'll talk about in another episode. But really a cool place at full of different exhibits, but extinct nonetheless.
Well, guys, through exploring all these extinct attractions, it's clear to see that Tomorrowland was all about the future of travel, the future of commerce, the future of exploration, and the future of humanity.
And one of the things that mattered most to folks was what innovations could be seen inside the home. But that's a story for the next episode.
Wait, does that mean this is going to be a 4-episode introduction to the Land of Tomorrow?
It does indeed.
Ooh.
We don't have any other choice at this point. We haven't even gotten to explore the major refurbishments the land had in 1967 and 1998.
Right. Well, it sounds like we've saved the best for last then. Join us next time as we put a giant steampunk bow on this incredible series, covering all the ins and outs of the exciting, tumultuous, and fantastic world of the future built by Walt Disney.
Well, sorry, that was really good, Annie. I was like, I was enraptured by what you were saying. That was awesome. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening, my friends. If you would like to hear even more from the gang here at the entire BSOW network, be sure to jump over to our Patreon. You will find that at www.patreon.com/BSOW network. That's www.patreon.com/BSOW network. Over there, you'll be able to become a member and get access to hours of additional content from shows like Did You Know Disney, BSOW Backstage, and maybe a few more in the future.
You can also follow us on the socials by searching for the Backside of Water podcast on Instagram and Facebook. You can also follow me, Freddie, by searching for State Your Socials Here. Oh, I'm sorry, at Skipper Freddie.
I'm not on social media very much these days, but you can find me at Annie Rugit, R-U-Y-G-T, on Instagram.
And until next time, as you exit, please watch your head and watch your step. And if you happen to miss your step and hit your head, please watch your language. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.